Ladies and gentlemen, as the tiramisu surges through your veins, don't let me disturb you while I just give a few house cleaning tips. I'm Martin Mertz from the Professional Committee, and I'd like to welcome you all here and just let you know of a few of the exciting events we've got coming up, starting with Lawrence E. Lipscher, pleased to be standing, who will be speaking tomorrow at lunchtime about American tax issues, and it's fully booked, so there's not much point in saying any more. But being fully booked tells you all you need to know. Then we've got A Deadly Profession, How to Confront the Dangers of Modern Journalism, moderated by Eric Weishart of AFP on Wednesday at 6 p.m. Then From Too Big to Fail to the U.S. Presidential Election, Perspectives from a Former U.S. Treasury Insider, Michelle Davis, on March the 13th, lunchtime. And then The Outlook for the Chinese Real Estate Market on March 15 by Jiang Xin, CEO and co-founder of Soho China. And tonight we have the documentary screening, a Richard Hughes film, which we've all come here for. And the film is 55 minutes, so rather than me rattle on, I'll just quickly introduce Sarah, who will introduce the film. And she wants to be known only as Richard Hughes's goddaughter. So despite all of us knowing that she has many more very colourful hats, we'll bring onto the stage now Sarah Monk's goddaughter of Richard Hughes.
Thank you very much, Martin. And it is indeed a great privilege to be standing here talking to all of you, because I'm normally down there listening. I was very happy when Anna kindly invited me to introduce this Australian documentary about the fabulous Hughes family. It's also the rounding of a circle, because my godfather, Richard Hughes, a loyal friend of my late father and war correspondent, Noel Monks, was the one who introduced me to the FCC in 1978. Dick Hughes was also my entree to the Hong Kong of his remarkable life and times. I use the word remarkable because Dick always corrected anybody who used the word fabulous, which I just did to describe his family. He loathed what he termed imprecise language. This ambitious documentary that the club has obtained to show to you all tonight is a heady cocktail of writers, performers, spies and priests, war and peace. It covers four generations of a multi-talented family, mostly in Australia, but it returns several times to this place, the FCC, where so much of the Hughes family legend is anchored, and it is also where other club legends like Hugh Van Ness and Anthony Lawrence were interviewed for this film. Anna encouraged me to share a few personal anecdotes about Dick. I'm very much indebted to the late Kevin Sinclair, one of Dick's closest, dearest friends, for having preserved so many anecdotes in his marvelous South China Morning Post tribute to Dick when Dick died back in 1984. And Kit Sinclair, who is with us tonight, knows all of these anecdotes very well. While he was simply Uncle Dick to me, and I knew him since I was probably 1 year old, to all of those who sought out Richard Hughes at the Foreign Correspondence Club, he was the doyen. He was the famous Sunday Times correspondent who also wrote Traveller's Tales for the Far Eastern Economic Review. An Australian with the build of a heavyweight boxer, his beat was pre-war Shanghai and Japan, wartime North Africa, where he first took to wearing a monocle to irritate pompous British Army officers, and Cold War Asia. His 1968 classic, Borrowed Place, Borrowed Time, was compulsory reading for anybody coming to Hong Kong, and I just want to show you this. It's still on sale in the bookshops in Hong Kong today, and I really do recommend it. It does stand the test of time. But Dick would have none of this doyen stuff. That's just another way of saying I'm the oldest whore in the house, was how he used to complain. But for Jean Le Carré, Dick was old craw, a character waiting to be written into his best-selling spy novel, The Honorable Schoolboy. For Dick's Sunday Times boss, Ian Fleming, he was also Dicko Henderson, an unforgettable character in You Only Live Twice, the James Bond novel from which this particular documentary takes its title. Dick was an attentive godfather to several children of his correspondent colleagues and friends. I can reveal, for example, that the man who scored one of the greatest scoops of the 20th century, flushing out the missing British spies, Burgess and Maclean, in Moscow, was equally good at finding the most exciting toys for young children at Hamleys in London. The man who wrote Foreign Devil, 30 years of reporting in the Far East, delighted in sending postcards from war-torn Saigon, and it would show himself with the spires of Saigon Cathedral poking out of the top of his head, making him look like a devil. Dick, who described himself as a very bad Catholic, would nonetheless take on the role of inquisitor with people like myself. He would put his monocle into his eye and say, "Goddaughter, when did you last go to confession?" For him, the answer was very easy, 1926. I suppose I must have passed the test because I later became the godmother to Dick's first granddaughter, one of whom you will see in the film tonight. I was very fortunate to see much more of Uncle Dick, as I called him, in his later years. His customary greeting, sitting here in the FCC, was in a strange Vatican lingo that harked way back, probably to the 1930s. Everyone was, "Your Grace, Eminence, Monsignor, my son," his favorite name for Kevin Sinclair. There was only one Mother Superior. That, of course, was Claire Hollingworth, and she was not amused. When he wasn't at the FCC, Dick presided over uproarious lunches at the Hilton Grill, fueled by Russian water, as he liked to describe vodka, as we call it in this club, or vodka. He always ordered beef tartare, followed by roast beef without Yorkshire pudding, and strawberries with kirsch. Though more accurately, it was kirsch with strawberries by the time Dick had jogged the elbow of the waiter bearing the liqueur bottle. There was a Dickensian flavor to Dick's philosophizing. "So from day to day we ripe and rot," was one of his favorite expressions. Another was, "God bless us one and all," said Tiny Tim, the boy with the syphilitic hip. That one got more difficult to say as the lunches wore on. Dick's doleful excuse for these feasts was, "But I only have one meal a day." UPI's Charlie Smith would always respond in his Alabama drawl, "Yeah, but it lasts 6 hours." Dick was a core member of that mysterious all-male drinking society Alcoholics Synonymous, which I understand still meets here at the FCC on Saturdays. Don't put your hands up, I know it's secret. Late one Saturday afternoon, I pulled up outside the FCC to witness Dick, who was a commander of the British Empire, drawing a sword from his walking stick. Of course, this was an entirely illegal weapon. This was so that he could knight Derek Davis, the former editor of the Far Eastern Economic Review, who was kneeling on the footpath. And of course, there he was with the sword going on either shoulder. Now, quite what the Anglican Archbishop made of all of this, peering out of his window, who knows? Heaven only knows. Finally, I think it's very important to mention, especially when you see this documentary, that Dick placed women on a pedestal. Never marry a Chinese, he would say, beaming at Anne, his elegant and beloved Chinese wife. She was from Shanghai. He would continue the sentence, they rule you with a rod of iron disguised as flowers. But behind his gregarious persona, Dick was a deeply private man. His flat in Shepherd's Court, Conduit Road, was off limits. Sundays were sacred. Dick and Anne even invented a private language to deter anybody from eavesdropping on their conversations. In this documentary, Dick Senior, as we call him, and you'll see why in a moment, because there is a Dick Junior, plays only one part. But though he has been gone for many years, he still plays it larger than life. One can only speculate as to what he would think of what we are about to see. But before we start the film, I'd like to propose a toast. A favourite toast of Dick's on what today would have been his 106th birthday. Two absent friends. Thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy the film.
So the film is 55 minutes, and if you still have energy afterwards, we might have a seminar at the conclusion.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome this evening. It is with great pleasure I introduce you to Mr. Richard Hughes, Jr.
We are in the process of making a film.
Act natural all the time, but don't get au natural.
About myself, my father Richard Hughes, my grandfather Richard Hughes, and later to be revealed in this box. No, we haven't got my great-grandfather in this box, but we've got something representing my great-grandfather, also Richard Hughes. Now, I thought the film would be called A Girl with Three Dicks, but it's not that kind of film.
Really struck me was a kind of fearlessness about her, a shamelessness.
Her spirit, her focus, her charisma, I think it's extremely energizing.
She's exuberant, inventive, and above all, she kind of has given vulgarity a good name.
Yeah, he's a great performer. He played the piano just like I wanted to hear it played, you know, fantastic.
It has the beat and rhythm and exertion of a rock drummer, really.
When Dick got rolling, he would really roll and begin to rock the piano up and down, actually shaking back and forth, and people loved that. They thought, you know, man, he makes that piano move.
Some people, very, very few, become part of the mythology of their profession.
Richard Hughes was the doyen of Far Eastern correspondence. I mean, he was widely acknowledged to be the best.
He had a great personality. I mean, as soon as you walked in anywhere, I mean, you know, just... That's Richard Hughes.
Never really given me any sort of singing instruction or direction. He's always just trusted my instinct to sing how I want to sing.
I think we were and possibly are now and possibly will be again the only father-daughter partnership in jazz. I say unique.
The word is sugar. I call my baby my sugar. My name is Little Sugar. Cool.
You had plenty money, 1922.
Dick Hughes is one of the best-known jazz pianists in Australia. You've heard of him, no doubt. His 16-year-old daughter, Krista, who seemed to amuse a lot of the crew here, we found out who the straight ones were tonight, has apparently inherited some of her father's talent and has been described by a black American blues veteran, Brownie McGee, as the greatest young blues talent in years.
You sit down wondering what it's all about. If you ain't got no money, they will put you out. Why don't you do right?
I think it was Dad's idea. I'm quite sure it was. When I was singing then, I wasn't at all interested so much in performance or the look at me, look at me. I was one of those painfully shy people and terrified of making any eye contact with anyone in the room. But I grew out of that eventually.
Gradually, the transformation started into being the class clown. And so she used to love stirring. She became a natural comedian.
Some of the stuff you're doing now, Krista, very jazz, Bessie Smith sort of songs. Now, you're only 18 years old. Why aren't you doing Stock Aitken, Waterman, Kylie Minogue type gear?
Because I think I've got a bit of style to my act myself.
Miss Lizzie Green of New Orleans runs a good time flat.
Now, listen, when did you discover that you had a singer right under your roof?
I'd be trying to get to sleep, and I'd hear my favourite Jelly Roll Morton records, my favourite Billie Holiday and Bessie Smith records.
I thought I'd discovered something new. Has anyone heard this? This is amazing. You've got to listen to this. So Mum was a bit concerned. Dad, on the other hand, loved it because he'd sort of like go, like, she's playing Jelly Roll Morton.
He's always been very supportive, competitively so.
She used to come down and play with us when she was beginning her career, and Dick would let her sing a song and sometimes he'd play along with her. So I thought, this is a delicate thing to do, to get your own child up on stage, but there's a lovely trust, I thought, between them that he did that.
Mr. Sean Parker, the love of my life.
Hello.
Come and pick the singer, Sean.
G'day, Richard. How are you?
Come in.
He wants us to pick the singer.
Who's the singer?
It's not Frank Sinatra, is it?
It is Frank Sinatra.
Ah, well done.
He's a professional bullshit artist in the sense he can act, he can do voiceovers, he can talk anyone into anything.
He can do that, yeah.
Originally from Grenfell, though, so he's a country boy.
The way to a Hughes girl.
And I guess because Sean was brought up on a sheep farm where they have to shout enormous lengths at great volumes to be heard across paddocks, he fit in beautifully.
Vashti put this together for my birthday.
Whippets are Stephanie's, like Dad's Louis Armstrong or Sydney Bechet is what Whippets do for Stephanie's.
Yeah.
They're all really quite excitable, but they're extremely supportive of each other. And they seek each other's company very much. They spend a lot of time together.
Toast for our absent friends?
Yes.
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 The afterlife!
The afterlife!
The huge thing is very much, well, it's my moment now and I'm not letting go of it. It's definitely a little bit about the limelight and having it and using it.
And I remember one chap, when Ellington sat down to play the piano, I said, "Now, come on, play your most famous one." And Ellington said, "Which one is that?"
I didn't show him.
Mum and Dad had a very... Well, they had quite a gregarious social life, and there were often people over. Vashi could not wait to be a part of it. Stephanie would just run around showing off as much as she possibly could. It's a bit a competition of the loudest person gets heard. And quite frankly, the loudest person is Krista. So she's got the power of the sound.
What's it called again, please? What's the title?
Freaks. Todd Browning's
right.
Freaks.
Right, now, but...
I've been on the earth, and you see all these people go, and look away, and you haven't seen her yet, then you get the whole backstory.
Yes,
then you see there, she's being chicken lady.
I've thought of this several times since you showed it to me.
Living with Richard,
she's going to die,
just to speak at times is a competition. Mum holds the family together. I don't know, it would have been a nut house probably if Mum was otherwise.
And you look a bit like the woman in Freaks. Remember the one that they turned into chicken? Yeah.
Hong Kong. Here, East meets West, and days merge into nights of ceaseless action. This is home to one of Australia's famous foreign correspondents, a man whose adventures in Asia have been a source of cloak and dagger fiction.
You were sitting in the eastern side of the bar of the Foreign Correspondents Club in Hong Kong, and David Greenway of the Washington Post brought me along to meet you. If you meet one person in Hong Kong, he said you have to meet Dick Hughes, as if you were a kind of journalistic Eiffel Tower.
He was a very gregarious man and a very generous man.
He was a very complex man. He was a control man. He was a control freak, if you like. That, coupled with the wit and his knowledge and his phenomenal memory, you know, made him a very formidable bloke. And he was way ahead of all other correspondents in telling us what we knew about China.
Hughes, what's your technique of China watching? How do you go about it?
What you do here is we get all the translation. We get monitored accounts of all the radio stuff that goes out. We can see and talk to quietly, and after you've been here a while, trustingly, with refugees who are under examination by other people and who will tell you what's going on.
He was a historian, really, as well as a journalist. He was a very good writer. And I think he passed on to his son, Dick Hughes, you know, a great interest in language.
Greta didn't come out very often. The excitement level in our house was so high because the man had myth about him. If he came, we'd have a massive party, like, I don't know, 50 or 100 people would come. They'd want to hear Dick Hughes speak.
You had Granddad, you know, with his throng of very careful listeners hanging on to every word. And
Dad was in another corner with the record player screaming about who was playing the next solo and yelling and shouting. I guess Dad would be competing for Granddad's attention, but then Granddad would want to have the attention himself.
I think to some extent Dick suffered from what a lot of sons of famous people suffer from. I knew his father, and of course I know the Le Carré realisation of him into an old Cora in The Honourable Schoolboy. His father was a wonderful man, a very interesting fellow. I think Dick is immensely proud of his father, but on the other hand, he felt very much overshadowed by him.
Granddad lived a very extraordinary life and was a very interesting person. Unfortunately, an appalling father. At a very young age, Dad's mother, May, had committed suicide.
She died July the 5th, 1933, 2 days before my second birthday.
One night he came home and at the usual time, and she went in with the child to put the child to bed. She lay down for a while, and about an hour later, she came back into the room and said one word, finished. Cyanide. And he went, got a doctor, of course, but by then she was dead.
He left me with his parents, my grandparents, to bring me up and attend to my education. I think I knew then that I was going to lose him. His absence was present everywhere I went.
Hughes began in 1936 on the Daily Telegraph. By late 1939, following the outbreak of war, Hughes was seeing colleagues and friends head off to Europe as foreign or war correspondents. He made his way to Japan. For several months, he investigated the likelihood of Japan entering the war, and this was the start of Hughes's life as a war or foreign correspondent and the start of his lifelong fascination with Asia.
My friends, Australia has produced many talented and famous singers and performers. Unfortunately, this woman is not one of them, but we think she should be. Eurotrash is proud to present Krista.
When I left Australia, I was hoping to spend a few months in New York. I definitely had this yearning. It's like, what is on the other side of the world? And ended up spending quite a few years away. Went over to the UK, and there was much more of a sort of this very interesting underground sort of cabaret scene going on.
Your breath stinks of vomit. Your flyers half undone.
I was in London, and we went to this party. It was kind of a performance party come, you know, just get together of musicians. And then Krista came on and sang My Dirty Old Man. My kind of girl.
After my performance, I noticed this guy in a sort of a hobo coat swigging from a bottle of wine. So I just went over and cheers him and we got chatting. That was inevitably Chris Doyle.
The bar wasn't big enough for Krista, basically. To Hong Kong. There was, you know, the energy of the place too, because Hong Kong is a very, you know, up this point for a certain style of performance.
Look, I'm sure it's here.
Do you have the pink
papers? There's so much paperwork to bother about, but you can go crazy.
Well, don't worry about it. Just, if you've got your pink pages, I can take it from there.
Beg your pardon?
If you've got the pink pages, I can do it from there.
Oh, look, this is very annoying.
Richard, it doesn't matter. I can just
do this. It doesn't matter, for my pride, darling.
Look, think about your pride later. Just let's get it on.
Got a big crash from China. Good afternoon, and I hope it is a good afternoon. For Christmas, it was 1941. Walter gave me Sing, Sing, Sing by Benny Goodman and his orchestra, featuring Gene Creeper on the drums, Vito Musso on tenor saxophone, and Harry James on trumpet. It was fifth class, March 1941. That's when I started thinking about jazz, and I asked my Uncle Walter, what is this jazz business? And he said, there's a drummer, Jeannie Creeper. Oh, and he really goes mad on the drums. I'm thinking, there's something in this. Going mad while you're playing music, It's almost a sort of hysteria. I wanted to laugh. It was, but not as though it was ridiculous. I wanted to laugh out of the sheer happiness and exuberance of it all. And heavens, I wish I could play drums like that. I wish I could play drums. The piano, my grandparents relented in February 1947. I still remember my grandmother saying, with misplaced optimism, it might get you away from this accursed jazz.
His grandmother was very strict. I remember he said once, I'm not allowed to go to Luna Park in St Kilda. He had a fairly constricted upbringing, but I think that is closely related to the way he burst out in jazz.
This is what they call stride piano. Now, I never heard anything like this in my life. The whole room seemed to be rocking. That was my introduction to jazz, and I used the word crazy.
See now, Jerry, ah, Jerry. You're hard to get. Yeah, Jerry, Jerry.
I think when Dad first heard jazz, heard this music, and there was something in its rhythm, something in the pulse of that music that just excited Dad, that gave him this jolt that he has never recovered from. Cannot get enough of it.
I'm gonna get you yet. Cause Jerry, 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 gonna get you. Da-da-da-da-da.
My final guest tonight is the doyen of that most glamorous breed of journalist, a foreign correspondent. For 40 years, he's covered Asia with an insight and style which made him into one of the legendary figures of journalism. He was a friend of Ian Fleming, the author of the James Bond books, who portrayed him in You Only Live Twice as Dicko Henderson, a boozy, profane Australian.
Lord Dick is the sort of person he wanted to be. Big, tough, you know, fight it or fuck it sort of thing. Whereas Dick wanted to be like Fleming, articulate, suave, well-educated.
He was not interested in high culture. He was not interested in art galleries. Basically, he wanted to go to casinos, nightclubs, extremely expensive restaurants, and spend a lot of time in bars.
Ian Fleming was an amazingly contradictory character, a complex character, because on the one hand, he was this dashing naval commander who'd been the personal assistant to the Director of Naval Intelligence during the war. And then, of course, he was given the job of foreign manager of the Sunday Times.
He used to sit in the Sunday Times office with a large map behind him on which he would have pins for all the different correspondents that he was running at different times. And Fleming himself certainly used to imply, or liked to imply at sort of dinner parties, that he was secretly running something that was a sort of informal spy network at the same time.
And this is where Richard Hughes came in. He was sort of headhunted, and he was recruited to Ian Fleming's bunch of...
Right, You Only Live Twice. In some ways, it's sort of a travelogue. It's based so firm.
What are the stories that really stand out?
Most good stories depend on a pressman being in the right place at the right time. And for me, that was the Burgess and McLean story.
Burgess and McLean were the two great Soviet moles within the British establishment.
Although it was fairly clear what had happened, that they'd gone to the Soviet Union, there was no sort of confirmation of that.
When Fleming asked Hughes to go out and find them, it's conceivable that he'd been asked to do so by some of his former colleagues within intelligence. I wouldn't be at all surprised if that is where the idea came from.
Well, I drew up a list for the eyes of Bulgarin and Khrushchev, and I said, if you're going to be stupid enough not to say you know where Burgess and McLean are when you go to England, it just shows how stupidly you're advised by your information people. Because every press conference you give, you're going to be asked, where are Burgess and McLean, who've been missing for 6 years? And if you say still you don't know, you'll be roars of laughter, and they'll have cartoons drawn about you, and you'll muck up your whole trip. So I went, and I was getting ready to leave. The phone rang. Oh, Mr. Hudges, would you please come to room 101?
We know you were called by telephone to room 101 in the Hotel National. What was it like when you got there? What did you see?
I think that story was huge. I mean, the rediscovery of these two famous traitors would have set London alight.
There were two other gentlemen sitting opposite who I'd never seen before. One of them, a tall, good-looking man in a blue suit and red tie, who got up and said, I am Donald McLean. I read this in some surprise and consternation and even alarm at this, and then he said, he nodded, and then I said, well, this is the end of a long trail.
And that was absolutely the scoop of scoops. So I think, I think it was a brilliant thing to pull off.
Dick Hughes, this wonderful jazz pianist who wants to become a Trappist monk, the most severe order in the Catholic Church.
Through him.
It took a while for it to dawn on me that he was rather compulsive with his attendance at masses, and then it was revealed that he attended mass at least twice a day and had been known to go three times in a day.
I must confess that I'm doing it really for what I could call self and soul preservation. In fact, sometimes I'm so overcome by the desert of the soul, mind and heart that I'm tempted to despair. And that's why I go to Mass as often as I can, to get to heaven as quickly as possible without committing suicide.
The other side of his religion is, of course, his relationship to his father. You couldn't help noticing when you were talking to him how often he mentioned Richard and the fact that Richard had been a Catholic but had given that away. And this clearly was something that was quite important to the son.
He was never heavy-handed about it. However, I think he's worried about our souls and where they will be eternally.
Nothing would make him happier than one, two, or three of us becoming nuns.
It's a motherfucker. It's a motherfucker on a motorcycle.
The first show was at Hopetoun, where she came in on a motorbike. We opened up the side doors. She came in on the motorbike, and I thought, fucking, that's... Then she's in a nun's outfit.
Ladies and gentlemen, I confess, it's been 1 week since I've had a big, large, vibrating thing between my thighs.
And it strips out of a nun's outfit.
I like to get drunk. I like to get high. I just love it when my clothes fall off.
Starting to push my vulgarity limits when I was in the UK. And when I did get back to Australia after all that, there was Machine Gun Fellowship. It was like, that's the band for me.
We had this track, I had these lyrics, you know, to Motherfucker on a Motorcycle. Chrissy came in and just nailed this vocal. She just came up with a melody that for these fairly abstract lyrics. This guy called Michael Parisi, who was working for Mushroom Records, said, I love it. Wanted to do a record, wanted to put it out, and Krista was coming back at the same time, so I was like, okay, we better get a band together.
When Motherfucker on a Motorcycle came along, you could instantly tell that this was a band that really didn't give a shit about what you thought about them. It was a challenge that they put out there, musically and, of course, in the way that they played as well. Say what?
I think we had five lead singers. I think we had five people. There were seven in the band, but I think there were five of us convinced that we had to be noticed the most, and we would do whatever it took to be noticed the most. The loudness and the weirdness, there's a poetry about her. She just has it.
I really had no idea that something that Josephine Baker was doing, you know, almost 100 years ago would be considered outrageous and rude.
Krista is undoubtedly somebody who is able to subvert almost instinctively. And I think that comes through with trying to confront the audience and trying to get a reaction out of the audience, but also trying to make them go the extra distance.
We got banned for Krista taking a top off. Then it just went through the roof. We started selling out shows that went around Australia and the world. We used to say, it's all about the show, and we wanted them to feel like they'd either been violated or won the lottery. And that's why it worked. She always used to do these cartwheels in high heels, which was just amazing, and usually naked. You know, that was just hilarious. Like a roller coaster. She never took it seriously. I think she knew that it could explode at any moment.
Machine Gun Fellatio.
We had moments where we were going to punch each other, you know, but as soon as the curtain went back, bang.
Thank you.
remember one of the strict dance band type musicians saying, "What's all this boom, boom, boom business?"
Because Sydney revolved more around a jazz culture and he was right up there in it, so he was something like, you know, like a rock star is today.
Yeah, he did play like a brothel piano player and was part of that great tradition. And Dick was happy to claim that.
Barrack music from the Neurotics. And we got a lot of reaction that probably rock musicians got when they first started.
He came to London. Well, I knew about him before he arrived here. It was fantastic. Jazz piano player was coming over from Australia. And of course, I was terrified when he wanted to sit in, and he just instantly mingled, and he was one of us.
Well, I can hardly believe it. In fact, looking back, I still hardly believe it happened. That I managed to interview Sidney Bechet and Billie Holiday.
I have with me now one of the great geniuses of jazz, that is Sidney Bechet. Well, Sidney, how long have you been in France now?
Well, I've been in France now ever since 1949.
He used to go down to hear Sidney Bechet in this dive in the middle of Paris, and he heard this tune, "Un Moyen de Payer," and he asked Bechet about it, and Bechet said that he composed this film in which Erich von Stroheim appeared.
And this is history, because right now this is the hottest trad jazz record made by an Australian group.
"Un Moyen de Payer." Great.
It was just such a haunting piece. Leonard Bernstein once said of jazz that even in the saddest low-down blues, there's always a hint of hope. And even the most boisterous Dixieland ensemble, there's always a touch of sadness.
He was playing with the Ray Price Group, and that's where I first saw him.
And she said, "I know who you are." It gives you an idea of what crowds we got that I hadn't noticed her before, because I certainly did that day. She could act. She had a stage presence, and she was in a couple of television shows too. She knew about the music. She seemed genuinely, intrinsically, and altruistically interested in me.
But Richard did ask me to marry him. I think it was probably the third time we went out. And I thought, oh, yeah, I guess that'd be all right. It wasn't very serious. But I said, first, I'm still going away. We'll see when I come back.
It wasn't until he met Faye that the lightning struck. Well, that was it. He found his girl there.
So I'm sitting next to him in the Opera House, and we were watching Krista perform.
"Darling, the stars, they shine for you. My darling, the birds..."
It starts off and it's beautiful. It sounds almost like an old Noel Coward track. And I looked over at Dad's face and I could see him just going into a boy-like reverie. And then she proceeded to sing,
"Have me on all fours, howling at the sky. I'll give your cock a good long suck, then you'll give me a good hard fuck."
His face went ashen, and then he had to get up and leave.
"Be your butt-hot, greasy slut."
I just thought, oh, Krista.
"Let me be..."
The music Dick started playing when he was young was, to many people, as outrageous as what Chris is doing now.
I don't know where it comes from, but it covers a revolt against me, really. Known for my pious ways.
After one of her performances, Dick said to me, I must say that I'm astounded to learn what Chris has been doing. But she's undoubtedly a star.
He's bigger than life, facing a thousand deaths, and you only live twice.
We're too late.
Well, at least he died on the job.
How did you react to Ian Fleming's portrayal of you in the bomb book?
I said, dear Ian, there's a limit to this portrayal of me as this hard-punching, hard-drinking, hard-wenching secret agent. I'm going to sue you for libel. And his reply to me was, dear Dicko, please go ahead. If you look like Willie, I'll write the truth about you.
After the Honourable Schoolboy came out, I took my life in my hands and I asked him point blank, so, have you been a spy? And he put his monocle in his eye and he looked and he gave you that look which said, don't go there.
I sincerely doubt that he was ever involved in that kind of stuff. And if he was, he was a bloody good agent because nobody ever, you know, would have realized it.
When I had this conversation with Richard, it was almost like as though I was a priest. It poured out of him, you know, everything that he'd been done, had been doing in the way of espionage. I couldn't stop him. He was a great friend with a man called Nicholas Dementiev, who was the culture advisor at the Soviet embassy. Dementiev said to him, would you help me in my job?
Hughes contacted Fleming and told him that he'd been approached by the KGB. Fleming arranged for the British Secret Service to provide Hughes with tidbits of information that would be seemingly significant and which would support his cover as somebody who was working for the KGB.
He pretended that he was amiable, easygoing, and didn't mean a great deal to anybody or anything. He cultivated that because that covered what he was doing.
If you tell me that Richard Hughes Sr. was a spy in Hong Kong, well, I wouldn't be surprised. Nothing would surprise me if you're talking about the Hughes family. They are all actors, and I mean that in the most appreciative and kindly and respectful fashion.
Get down!
Mumming all out the piano played in here. But Dick Hughes is my name, and playing hot piano, that's my game. Mumming all out the piano played in here.
Dick is, he inhabits his music, I think, in a very interesting way. I'd say actor, but it's something else, and he goes right into them. And I think as a musician, he's not playing from the outside, he's playing it very much from deep inside it. I've seen him almost go shamanistic when he's playing. It's a kind of jubilant shout.
We can sell them.
That's the shot.
Do you want to just do an intro? And...
yeah. Right now?
Yeah. Richard Hughes Sr., from what I gather, would have been quite an extraordinary ventriloquist. He had shows featuring not just one doll, his favourite doll being Tommy Squarehead, but apparently he used to do shows where he had several dolls that he was and controlling in the voices of all of them.
He wrote a little book about it, and it became quite famous. And he made quite a bit of money.
I was about 8 or 9. I came across that book of my grandfather's, How to Be a Ventriloquist, and I remember being surprised myself that in one of them was the phrase, shut up. And to my grandmother, that was tantamount to swearing. You see, he had converted to the Catholic Church to marry my grandmother, who came from a strict Catholic family. So I think she could have had a prejudice against showbiz and show people. Of course, jazz to both of them is utterly despicable. Absolutely the last word, beyond the pale, entirely. My father had a theory that his father and his mother had some row about going to do these shows. And he would have said, because he was a pig-headed man in many ways, he'd say, well, all right, that's the end of ventriloquism, I've finished.
His mother was dominant, and she was strictly Catholic. His father was not. He was a gentle old boy, the father.
If my radiator gets too hot, cool it off with your love and stuff. You got to give me all the service you got. Come on and do your duty.
He rarely talked about the past. He did occasionally. He would, from time to time, say, I'm a failure. Not in a despondent way, just as a matter of fact way. I'm a failure. You're doing well, Richard, the family's doing well, and your father's an internationally respected correspondent, but I'm a failure. I think there could have been some oblique way of suggesting that had he stayed as a showman, he would have been a success.
So come and help me find somebody to do your duty.
Watching Krista performing at Circus Oz was really like watching a tightrope act, and she is really quite an astounding and outrageous performer, but very much, I think, in the great vaudeville tradition. She's not like anyone else.
She's rock and roll, she's jazz, she's blues, she's performance, she's cabaret. And I think in some ways that's has been her biggest problem, is that she's just too good in some ways and too many things.
Roll out, roll out, roll out, roll out, roll out.
She just seems, you know, a force of uncontrollable nature.
You know, directing her is like hanging on some kind of helium balloon that's lifting you up, and you're just trying to pull it down a little bit.
There's a bit of me that does tend to, in situations like that, want to ham things up or start to take the piss or make it into parody, and that was the last thing I really wanted to do today, because that will not go down well at all. You must have been terrified, like, oh, it's a fiancé. Incredible. In front of them. Here it is.
We'd been flying backwards and forwards, catching up with each other at every available opportunity around this, around the last tour with Circus Oz. And we met up at Sydney Airport and then flew to Melbourne together that night. And then the next day in St Kilda, I asked Krista to marry me.
And I said yes.
Well, yeah.
Pretty simple.
You wear stakes.
There was no ring, there was no stakes, no collar. It was a pretty spontaneous thing.
It wasn't really premeditated or anything.
No,
Crystal, we were just having a very, very...
I was thinking, oh, how embarrassing, you didn't mean that.
Happy moment. And Crystal, Crystal turned around and said to me, Sean, I'm so happy, I want us to be together forever. And I said, well, do you? And she said, yes. And then I asked her to marry me. And realised what I'd said as I said it, but I'm very, very happy with what we're doing.
Yeah. So funny talking about this. Yeah. Sorry. It seemed really corny or something. I don't know. We'd been invited to go to the Foreign Correspondents Club in Hong Kong, inevitably see and bump into and meet people that did know Granddad and possibly a lot better than Dad did. I was quite concerned how Dad would react, if it would send him a bit bonkers or hurt him.
Richard Hughes.
Oh, Richard.
It's a very famous name.
Well, here's the son.
No, you're
Richard
the son.
Hughes
Jr.
Yes.
Really?
Yes. No,
I knew your father. Everybody knows him because he appeared in the spy book. He was featured in, what's his name, the writer of spy stories.
Ian Fleming, yes.
John le Carré.
First
of all, everybody wants to see him. Thank you.
It does seem very strange not having Dick here, because you're immediately thrown into his way of life. So on arrival, you'd be taken straight to the Hilton, and the drinks would start, and it just went from there. His own personality was very established within himself, and I think wherever he put Dick, he'd be just the same. All those years in Hong Kong, he got the information that others couldn't get without speaking Chinese.
There we are. Hold on.
Right, well, look, you're here. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's recognisable.
Yeah. Quite recognisable.
Yeah. He walked straight in and said, it's great.
Of course, you're Eileen and Olive.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, I've never seen that photo before. Nor do I know what the cap and gown's all about. He might have been made honorary doctor or something, forgot to tell me lots of things. I don't think any of us would ever know the real Dick, the real Richard Hughes and what and all that he did. And I'm sure I don't.
He and his son didn't get on very well, you know. Young Richard might deny this, but I saw it. He found it difficult to get close to anybody unless there was a dividend to be paid.
So if we could bring this back around this way, so it's a bit more...
I'll leave it entirely up to you now.
Okay.
Entirely.
Yeah.
Well, I know there'll always be some sadness that he never really knew his father. And maybe that's why he has been such a close father to myself and Vashti and Stephanie.
I said to Dad, I said, look, I've seen you so miserably, pathetically few times in Hong Kong when you're alive. So I'm not going to go up there when you're dead, but rest assured, Your Grace, Your Eminence, I beg your pardon, I shall be praying for the repose of your soul, which I still am.
Instead of forgetting with somebody else. Dad.
in many ways a man of mystery, and I think it's a role he relished.
I think that's the first time I really did make an effort to understand who was Granddad, what did he do, and it's actually been quite recent that I've kind of stopped resenting Granddad so much.
He was the best and the wisest man I've ever known.
I never thought I'd be getting married in a Catholic church, and I think Monsignor Doherty's really cool for having us.
I'll meet you at the door, front door. He'll be hanging on to you, and you'll be sort of...
Lurching.
I knew I didn't want it on a clifftop with a hippie celebrant. I guess one of the initial thoughts was this would make Dad so happy, and then with that thought, and of course, and I thought, well, hold on, I can't do it just to make Dad happy if it feels false to me. It doesn't feel false to me at all. As the more I thought about it, I was like, actually, I'd really like that. And as it turns out, you know, this church, I was baptised in this church. I had my whole first Holy Communion in this church, my first confession in this church. I was confirmed in this church, so might as well do the fifth sacrament. Wedding in this church. Don't have the urge to rebel against them nearly as often as I used to in the past. Makes things a lot easier, like weddings.
There's no doubt that there's that legacy which goes on through his children, his son Richard, and through his grandchildren, all of whom have inherited his extraordinary gregarious personality and his enormous gifts, one way or the other, whether it's in music or in performance or in writing.
I'd like to say good luck. What's one of the nicest things you know of your daughter here? What are the things you're most proud of this beautiful girl?
I give you this ring as a sign of my love.
I honour you forever.
I honour you forever.
Wonderful. Terrific. Sharon Krista, I bless you that you might live fully, that you might love wastefully, and that you always have the courage to be the people you are called to be. I bless you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
That concludes our ritual. We're going to sign some papers now and then release these two on an unsuspecting society, I think. But anyway.
I think the Hughes family is an important Australian family, where talent of various kinds is passed on from one to the next. And I hope it does continue in their case, because they brought not only a kind of energy and liveliness to our lives, but also a sort of beauty, really.
She's the circus runaway, girl with a rock and roll lifestyle, Krista Gibbons!
Come again. Costs way too much these days. $350 a grand, you've got to be joking! working. So I've just had to slight it. LSD lost her way too long. I had a brain, then I fried it. There's something cheap and nasty on the market. By God, I like it. Why deny it?
I see you're all still in your seats. I've got to do one little ritual. Every speaker here gets a gift pack from the FCC. So, Sarah? Well, seeing people are all still here, we can go through the ritual of Q&A if you like. Okay. Who will ask the first question? I will. How many people actually knew Richard Hughes personally? Hands up. Ooh, that's a lot. Okay, first question. Well, there's dozens of them. You'll have to fight each other to have the first right to tell a short anecdote. Who would like to? Oh, they're all... Okay.
What do you think? Was he or wasn't he a spy?
His biographer, Norman McSwan, concluded that he was. But he also said he felt it was fairly low-grade disinformation, that it was that part of the Cold War involving Bangkok, Moscow. It was very difficult for there to be any Russians in this part of the world because of the Sino-Soviet split. But I think it's possible. I think it's possible. I think ultimately he was the perfect spy character, but he may not have been the perfect spy.
Good answer.
Anyone else? Okay, Mr. Thomas back here.
Ted Thomas. I knew him for many, many years, as you know. Had lunch with him regularly. And still occasionally go to the group that he founded, which was called the Old Hiltonians, and still has a lunch every now and again with charity. The one point I wanted to make was the monocle. And he told me one day that no real gentleman would ever have a ribbon on a monocle. It had to fit into your eye perfectly. And the only reason he started ever wearing a monocle was because it amused him, as you said, in North Africa. But the monocles he wore, which are, of course, for people with better eyesight in one eye than the other, the monocles he wore were plain glass and cost absolutely nothing. And what he used them for was when he wanted to demonstrate anger, he'd throw them to the floor and stamp all over them, and they didn't cost him a penny. Thank you.
Anyone else? This is probably the latest we've had at dinner here, so I guess you all really like documentaries. And I can tell you about the one that didn't make it, the Academy Award winning The Cove, and the trainer of Flipper was trying to come here in this month, but we had so many events we couldn't fit him in. So write angry letters to the committee and say we want Flipper's trainer to talk about the slaughter of dolphins in his Academy Award winning documentary. Thank you all for coming this night, and hope to see you again at another documentary session.